Hi, and welcome to the Robert Orlowski Show. Whether you watch with our friends over at Turning Time, or wherever you watch or listen to your podcast, as always, it's exciting to have you along for the experience. And we have a special podcast for you today. But first, let's do our sponsorship. Thank you so much for the personal bar mitzvah video for Yisrael. I am certain it will make him very happy. He wanted us to sponsor an episode in honor of his bar mitzvah. Now, I don't know if you remember Yisrael. This is, since there is all the Rabbi Orlowski crazies out there who've probably committed every podcast to memory, you'll remember at one point that this kid wrote in and said that he's a big fan and he watches all the shows, you know, and shares it with people. And could I give him a shout out? And I said, no. That's Israel. So he came bar mitzvah and he wants to sponsor an episode. What better way to join Klal Yisrael and become an adult and to sponsor the Rabbi Orlowski Show? So mazel tov, and may you go on and do great things in this world. And now I would like to introduce this very special podcast. You know, there are some people who always enjoy it whenever we have guests on the Rabbi Orlowski Show. There are some people who don't because they only want to hear me talk over and over and over and over and over again. But listen, variety is the spice of life. Yeah. So I have on the podcast for the first time an old friend. Also, I know him a long time. And then... and that is Menachem Nissel, who is sort of English. I say he's sort of English because he spent enough time in Memphis that now his accent is unrecognizable either to English people or to Americans. And it's become something of an amalgam. He has become a legend in the field of Chinuch and Habotzes HaTorah in Kiruv Rechokim. And he also plays a mean guitar. And he's been around for a long time. A very, very long time. He holds it better than I do, Baruch Hashem. But he's getting white. My gosh, I didn't even realize it. Yeah, so, but he still has that youthful charm to him. In any event, we're here. Actually, there's so many things we could discuss with all of his years of experience in Chinuch and Habotzes HaTorah. But we're here to talk about one particular thing, and that is the new book that he has just put out called Looking Into the Sun, which is about Reb Moshe Shapiro. And I can say he wrote the book about his Rebbe, Reb Moshe Shapiro. And I can say he did not write the book about my Rebbe, Reb Moshe Shapiro. And I have said this many times. I am would not have the chutzpah to call myself a Talmud. And Reb Moshe agreed with me. This popped out once when there was a particular controversy that Reb Moshe was involved in, and I somehow got pulled into the controversy, and there were some big people who were attacking me. And I went to Reb Moshe, and I said to Reb Moshe, I said, I don't know why they're angry at me. It's like, you know, I'm a nobody. It's like if you're, you know, angry at the king, you don't kill the jester, you know? I said, and, you know, basically, you know, if Reb Moshe wanted to get a message out there, he wouldn't have said, hey, that guy sitting in the fourth row who doesn't know anything that's going on, I want him to represent me. And Reb Moshe said, it's really very funny, which is not what I was hoping for, but it did confirm exactly how I felt. So, I felt that I was zoiche to have a kesher with Reb Moshe. And in that regard, I am among thousands of people who felt that they had a close kesher with Reb Moshe. I know this for a fact. There were thousands of people who depended on Reb Moshe. How it was possible, I don't know. And there was never a time when I said to Reb Moshe, I need to speak with you, or I have to bring one of my kids to you, that he didn't make time within the next 24 hours to make that happen. And he did this for thousands of people. I don't know where the time came in the day. It was something astronomical. And that's why it's interesting. This book was published by Feldheim. It's not an art school book. And I'll tell you why. I'm going to theorize here why. Somebody came back from Moshe's Levaya and he says, the Hespedim were generic. And anyone who knew Rav Moshe Shapiro, he was not generic. I don't think there was ever a Gadol B'Yisrael who was generic. But there's a tendency today to sanitize and mass produce Gedolim so that everybody fits into a particular, you know, little square. And Rav Moshe would never have felt fit into any particular square. He was too big for that. Jonathan Rosenblum told me when he was writing the biography on Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, there was a particular story where Rav Yaakov said, if it was me, I would have thrown him down the stairs. And Art School said, no, we can't write that. So he said, I would have shown him to the door. But Rav Yaakov said, I would have thrown him down the stairs. And that's exactly what he meant. And there was a certain, you know, flavor to it. And therefore, I had a relationship with Rav Moshe Shapiro that defied anybody else's relationship. And when I hear certain people talk about Rav Moshe, that's not the Rav Moshe Shapiro that I knew. Chanuch Teller told me he had a relationship with Rav Moshe where they only spoke about Chinuch. That's all they spoke about. One time he knew everybody would go to this Thursday night shiur. There was hundreds of people. He showed up. You know, Rav Moshe was very short. And Chanuch Teller was very tall. And he had this long beard. You know, he's very, very distinguished looking. And Rav Moshe looks, grabs him by the beard, pulls him down to face level and says, what are you doing here? And he says, sorry, it won't happen again. He says, see that it doesn't. So that was his. I have a friend, Michal Kaplan, who's a Shas Yid. He's gone through Shas many times. And after Rav Moshe's daughter died, he used to give Shurim and Tyrus. And Michal Kaplan only went to his Shurim and Tyrus. He never went to any of the Sashka for Shurim. So there's such a wide variety of Rav Moshe. Well, when you speak about Rav Moshe, he's too big to fit into one particular schnit. But Rabbi Nissel has been one of his close talmidim, goes back a long, long time, and he's done a tremendous job trying to capture the various aspects of Rav Moshe in one book. And that's what we're here to talk about today. Rabbi Nissel, welcome to the Rabbi Olavsky Show.
Thank you, my dear friend Rav David. It's great to be here.
So you wrote a book.
Oh my gosh, I sure did.
Not your first book.
Not my first book.
I have quoted your other book a number of times. And Rigshay Lev.
Please continue to do so.
I remember you said something to me that made a deep impression on me, and that is the advantage of a book like Rigshay Lev is it keeps selling because it's a book on halacha. You know, it's just a novel, so it sells 3,000, 4,000, whatever amount it is, and then that's it. It goes into all the lending gemachim, and it's finished. But since it's a book on halacha, and this is a book on women's tefillah, which is a unique topic.
So, David, you know the scoop. Yeah. We're coming out with a new edition right now.
Oh, you really?
Oh, yeah.
You translated into Hebrew.
I know, but this is the expanded edition. It's about 20% bigger. It's got a lot of new halachas, new sections, and
it's going to be... I just quoted you in a question and answer. We have question and answer on a regular show. It's not an interview show at the end. And this woman was asking about taking care of little kids and having to daven. And right. I quoted your psak from Rabbi Scheinberg.
That's right.
You know, which was in the book. I quote the Rigshay Lev. So this is it. This is your second book.
Oh, this is very exciting. Yeah.
So what is this book and why?
So the Rav Moshe Sefer really began as a series of articles in Mishpacha magazine.
Right.
It just began. I wanted to bring Rav Moshe to an audience that just didn't know him. I figured that there has to be a way to spread Rav Moshe beyond his initial group of Talmidim.
He was pretty low key. Considering who he was, a lot of people didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
I think that was intentional.
Yeah, when I started writing this book, I found out very, very quickly that no one knew what he was doing the next hour and with whom. And he had literally dozens of different types of groups of people that he had unique connections to. Honestly, until he passed away, did you know what he did in France? Did you know what he did in South America?
I know he used to go to Russia.
Okay, so everyone knew about Rashi because we missed out on him on Pesach. But he made a massive revolution in France. He made a massive revolution in South America. He will be flown in just to speak to the leaders and to the machanchim and to the educators and to the Rosh Hashivas. And he had retreats where he would train them in how to change the world. And he did.
I know he used to go to the JLE in London.
Correct.
And that's why I heard from Rabbi Aubrey Hirsch, where he, an amazing thing, I mean, Rabbi Tatz writes about this in one of his books, but he says, I was there where people would ask multiple questions.
Right.
And then he would give one answer
right.
that would answer all of the questions.
Yeah.
Which is, okay, it's a good party trick. I mean, most people can't do that. Someone asked him once how he does it. And he says, when you look like this, it looks like there's four different things. You have to go down to the bottom and see the source. So to him, all of Torah was connected. It was
correct.
One whole. There was no things. So I know he was working in England. Was he in South America?
So no one knows.
How do you know about it?
He had a Hermione time turner. He had one of those. No one knows how he did it. But he went to South America with Ariel Cicero, who was my main feeder of the stories. I actually had a request last week by Rabbi Wanish in Buenos Aires. When can we translate the book into Spanish? So that's already in place.
Wow.
And what he did in South America and in Mexico was a totally different Ramesha. Let's give you an example. Okay. Give me two examples, actually. And when he went to Mexico City for the first time, it was a massive, massive gathering of people, all kinds of different people. Rabbi Cicero was in awe of the fact that after he finished speaking, people came and discussed Kabbalistic ideas about what he was saying. And other people coming in who didn't know a sefer and asking on the same share, like Aleph-based questions, and Ramosha asked them, answered them all equally. But what was incredible was that his take-home message in Mexico City was twofold. He said the two things Mexico City has to do to change the landscape of what the city is all about. Number one is that they have to work on Kirov. There has to be like Kirov organizations. Mexico City was...
He was like a Kirov proponent.
Yeah. So he pushed it.
Any of the, more contemporary Gedolim.
In our circles, this was his passion. He said he could not sleep at night knowing that there were trainloads of Jews going to Auschwitz in Los Angeles. His spiritual Auschwitz that he was talking about, he could not do with it. Let me just finish my sentence, Rav David. Don't distract me.
No, he sounds like Rav Noach.
Yeah, because there was...
Sounds like Rav Noach Weinberg.
Besides talking about Kirov, which we can get back to, he said at exactly the same time that Mexico City has to have chaburas where the top end are learning Kabbalah. And this was like, whoa, what's going on over here? And then he didn't just talk about it. He would not leave Mexico City until he set up chaburas of people learning what's called Teres Achein, Chochmas HaNistar. So he had that breath to be able to figure out what the community was all about, to figure out what needed to be fixed. And he was fixing simultaneously the two ends of what the community needed.
This emphasis on Kabbalah, apparently, he had gotten from Reb Dessler.
Correct.
And... That's what he told me once.
Yeah.
He says, I said, did Rav Dessler have a Masara? He says, not be dumb. He took some Hashkafa, he took some Kabbalah, he took some Hasidus, mixed it all together and called it Musa. he made it up, I said, well, did he have Misnagdim? He goes, yeah, his wife, she was terrible. She was very upset with what he did. But he told somebody once, the way you mechazek people in Amuna today is through Kabbalah.
Right.
And obviously there were different levels of it.
Exactly. It was very nuanced.
For example, do you know about the secret Kabbalah shiurim he gave in the middle of the night?
So I found out a lot about it afterwards.
I only found out about it because somebody asked me about it.
Yeah.
Someone said to me, when does he give the secret Kabbalah shiurim in the middle of the night? I was like, come again? Like, what do you think he shares this with me,
Right.
So I went to the Monday night shiur, which was not as intense as the Friday shiur that you went to,
Right.
And certainly not these. But one time somebody asked him a question, looks around the room and he says, Lopo.
Right.
That was too deep for here.
Right.
Because he noticed I was there. So he was going to say it in front of me.
At Thursday night, he would not give Myra McComas
yeah.
what he was saying. And in our share on the Friday show. So I was one of the babies over there. Yeah. Like, you know, talking about, there was me next to me, to my left was Rabbi Tatz, and then was Ramesha, and then there was like the big guns, all these Rosh Hashivas and people that had written Sifri Kabbalah. And there he would talk about stuff. I'm looking at my notes now, and slowly it's starting to merge. Maybe I understand a few things here and there.
But I always say the great thing about Ramesha is, it took me 3 years just to understand what he was talking about. Because he says things which I have no frame of reference for. Correct. I have no context for it.
Correct.
You know?
He once made a comment in our share that he expected everyone here to be familiar with the writings of the Leshem. And and to the Nefesh HaChaim back to front.
I remember, look, everyone knows the Spheres, right? 101, right? So is Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferes, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, and Malchus. And they correspond to the seven
dwarfs.
Roei Yisrael, Kulei Ushpizen, Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Moshe, Aaron, David, and Shlomo, Yosef, and David, right? Anyway, I'm in a shir, and he explains how Yosef is the Midi of Tiferes.
Yesod.
No. How Yosef is the Midah of Tiferes. The next week, he explains how Abraham is the Midah of Tiferes. The third week, he explains how Moshe is the Midah of Tiferes. Now, I know this. Yaakov is Tiferes. None of these people are. So I said to Yosef Brown, who, of course, has been going for 25 years at that point, I said, how could everyone be Tiferes except the one guy who's Tiferes? He says, David, don't you ever look at the end of Sfiris email over there? There's Chesed Shiva Gevura, Chesed Shiva Emes, Chesed Shiva. He's explaining the Tiferes of Chesed. He's explaining the Tiferes of Netzach. Yeah. Okay, I had no way of knowing that. There was no way I could pick up on that, you know? So it took me like 3 years to do it. And then it took me another 3 years to be able to say enough words to convince people that I knew what I was talking about, even though I clearly had no idea what I was talking about. You know, but I could say, yeah, Klipas. You know, it was a lot of fun, you know, but it was like, I went once to a Thursday night shiur and I was driving Rabbi Gershenfeld back. It was an old Talmud of Ramesha. And I said over, he said, that's an unbelievable thing he said. And I said it over, he goes, and him and the two other people in the car said, that's not what he said at all. I was like, sure it was. And they said, no, you got it completely, you mixed up everything that he said. It was a humbling experience.
Yeah, indeed.
You know, but in the words of Dirty Harry, a man's got to know his limitations.
I don't remember that part of Ramosha.
Please, there was one time when I got it right in the Tuesday show, and the other people didn't. And I said, let me ask Rav Moshe. I asked Rav Moshe. I says, did the Rav mean such and such? And he goes, of course. I said, because somebody said that you meant this. He goes, tell that person he should never come back to the shir. I was like, okay, I'm out. You know what I mean? But for the grace of God, so go I. I just got lucky this time. But it was so amazing because there was such a sweetness to him and such a concern for everybody. Here's one of my Rav Moshe stories. I don't know if you know this. There was someone in South America who had an androgynous, a hermaphrodite, half man, half woman. And they weren't sure what to do. So they came to Israel and they met with a big poysik. And he was like, oh my gosh, you know, you learn these sugyas, but you don't think it's ever going to be halakha l'maisa. And they went through all the halakhic things, etc. And then they went to Rav Moshe, and they said, you know, we had an androgynous, and he burst into tears.
Right.
At the same time, I was in a Thursday night shir, and some kid stands up and snaps a picture.
Oh, my gosh.
And everyone goes,
my heart is palpitating just thinking about that, yeah.
And Rav Moshe pauses, and he goes, say bavakasha.
Yeah.
And the kid freezes. It was like some OJ kid who was coming for his first time.
Shelovin.
You know the story?
Yeah, I know the story, yeah.
He goes, "O ato ani," either you or me. And the kid got up and walked out of the room. And I remember Dr. Reinfeld, who used to come all the time, the psychologist. I said, something inside of me died at that moment. But this is the same Ramesha who loves.
Can I just interrupt?
Yeah.
Okay. That story with the Shalavim boys, Rabbi Ari Waxman, told me that afterwards he was his rabbi. He had brought him there. He took him over to Ramesha. Ramesha sat with him for an hour. I'm not sure if the trauma was ever removed.
How do you, not for me, for sure.
Yeah, but the boy came out. Ramesha showed him a bigger picture and took him to a different place.
Well, which he had a bigger picture because he had a flash.
Yeah.
But how do you reconcile those two Ramesha's? Now, those are not the only contradictions I can give you for Reb Moshe, who was such a multifaceted individual, worked on so many different levels. But how do you explain that?
One of the problems of me working on this Sefer is that he had two Rebbeim. And there were, just generalizing, there were like two camps about who was the main Rebbe that directed the way he thought. It was the Reb Dessler camp and the Brisker Rav camp.
Now, with the Brisker Rav also goes Reb Hutna.
Okay, exactly.
Because both the Brisker Rav and Rav Hutna had a tremendous emphasis on Kavod HaTorah.
Exactly.
I mean, by Rav Hutna, you walked out backwards.
Exactly.
You wore your hat and jacket, you know, Kavod HaTorah. Not because that's who he was.
Right.
But that's how he held Kavod HaTorah has to go.
And one of the things Rav Moshe believed that our dar, our post-war dar, could still have is some kind of a vision of what Kavod HaTorah is all about. He wanted very, very much that there should be a sense of grandeur around Torah, and Torah should be something that would be like for a simple Jew who just had a university education, who was intelligent, but very weak in the world of Torah, would see that Torah is a totally different league. And so he carried himself with the Kavod HaMalchus. The word Malchus was a word that kept him coming up from all the people I spoke to. When our friend Josh Hartman took him to Prague, I asked Josh, what was the things that was like blew you away about Ramesh's Hanhaga when you were talking, working around Prague? So one of the things he mentioned was that whenever Ramesh would walk the streets in Prague, so all the non-Jews over there, they would literally like Chris Yamsov, they would just split, they would look at him and would realize they're in the presence of somebody elevated and they would just let him go through. And so he believed very strongly.
He was once, I don't know where I heard this story from. He was getting onto an LL flight, you know, and he's at security. And he goes, who packed your bags? And he goes, Ben Matt.
Yes.
And the guy's like, okay, go ahead. I've never had that experience, security.
Right.
But I mean, that's why he was sick of what was going on in Panovich.
Right.
You know, right. Because
literally sick. Literally, it made him literally sick. That story.
You know, the lack of Kavod HaTorah. You know that this could go on. He made an asifa there at one point to talk about Kavod HaTorah for exactly that reason. Because so it's such an interesting thing because to a certain extent he was playing a role.
Right.
You know, he felt I have an obligation of Kavod HaTorah, but himself is one of the most laid back people.
Yeah.
You know.
We saw it.
Fun.
We saw it with how we dealt with our own kids.
Yeah.
I mean, with our kids, he was a saba. He was like a fatherly kind of thing. I mean, Baruch Hashem, your Yaakov is stories to tell over.
Yeah. I mean, I know some stories of people working in Kirov, and he was talking to non-from people. And there was this love and this acceptance and this, like, you know.
Right.
I just couldn't believe it.
Right.
You know, someone said, I don't know, these kids, they grew up from, and now, they, you know, I don't know what to tell them. I don't know what this is. He says, they're right. You want to take away everything in their life, you better give them something in exchange. And if you don't have something, then you understand that they're going to have a tine on you. So, but to have that level of understanding and tolerance for everybody is just, and then at the same time, you know, come down like a ton of bricks.
Yeah. Yeah, which is of course an honor because if you came down in a ton of bricks, you were probably a Talmud. He probably was trying to build you as well.
Always tell this story. Yeah. You know, if you said something stupid, he'd rip you apart.
Right.
Really, mamish, just rip you apart, you know? In fact, there was somebody who was with him when he was in Stanford, and he was always giving a very hard time. And he says to him, he says, why are you always so hard on me? So he says, Kotuv. There's a malach that stands over every blade of grass with a stick and hits it and says, grow. The way it grows is by someone standing over you with a stick and hitting you. You heard this story?
Sure. I had.
Who was it? Do you remember who it was?
I don't remember.
Okay.
But I do remember another. When I was in Mishkan HaTorah, first of all.
So let's go back. I'm totally out of order here.
He did get
let's go back. How did you meet Reb Moshe? Where did it start?
So my opening story is just segues exactly into what you're saying.
You know what? I'm going to take you back further, right? You've done a little research into the life of Reb Moshe.
Right.
So he was born here in Eretz Yisrael.
Right.
His father?
He was a Tel Avivian. He grew up in secular Tel Aviv. And yeah, I mean, his father was an Aron Godel in his own right, but a total tzanua, a total hidden person. And
he was a dayan, his father?
No, he was a Rebbe in the yeshiva, in the Lomji yeshiva in Petah Tikva. And
I heard a story that when he got married, he told his father, "I don't want an apartment. I just want you to put on a frock." Is that true?
Makes sense. I never heard that before.
That's what I heard.
Yeah. No, but his father was an extraordinary person. One of the stories I bring down is that Ramesha, during the Shiva, told Ovid that his father, between himself, was extremely, extremely disciplined. Something happened. I don't remember the story exactly. Something happened when he was a teen that Ramesha's father took upon himself that whenever he wakes up in the middle of the night, before he turns his head and goes back to sleep, he would stand up next to his bed and then make a conscious decision. Remember, his father was a Kelmer, right? This is all about self-discipline. And decide whether he needs to sleep.
Now, when you said, remember, he was a Kelmer, how in the world could I possibly have known that?
Ramesha, yeah, this is a good point.
He's good like, point. Well, of course, he was a Kelmer. I don't know, he was a Kelmer.
Yeah, he was very self-disciplined. Towards the last decades of his life, he, every single day, did exactly the same thing. Ramesha's father would get up at, 11:30 at night. And he would go to sleep at 7 or 8. So he would sleep the evening hours. And then he would go straight. He would get dressed, go straight to learn. And he would learn all night long until the morning hours. The joke is that as he was passing Ichkovich, who's like the Shtibelech, so the Ger Hasidim would scream out and say, "Tzenta! Tzenta for Mar!" Like, we need a 10th person. He would say, "Are you guys, you're from yesterday. I'm from tomorrow morning," right there. And he'd come in Machal. So the crazy, crazy story was, is that the last, I don't remember exactly, but the last few weeks of his life, he was in a coma. And the nurses said that they saw something unprecedented with Ramesh's father. He said he would be there in his coma, like literally comatose, literally. But every night at exactly the same moment at 11:30, whenever it was, I don't remember the exact, 11:30, they would see him struggling with his bed sheets, trying to get up
wow.
In a coma. So first of all, that's Kelm. And yeah. Secondly, that's both the discipline that Ramesha had and the tznius that Ramesha had, because Ramesha was extremely hidden, that he got from his father directly. And Rav Dessler was a family member.
Okay, so 1 second. So now he's in secular Tel Aviv. He goes to Cheder?
Yeah, so he told over when his mother passed away, he told over the Shiva that the greatness of his mom, I can't remember the exact date, he was 10 years old or 11 years old, his mother sent him to learn in Petah Tikva. And
until then, he was in Tel Aviv and some there was a cheder there?
I have no idea. Till nine years old, that did not make it yet.
He had stories.
He told stories about his neighbor that had dogs. Ramesha was obsessed with everything that included knowledge. So when he talked about Kalev, he spoke about his secular neighbor upstairs that had like half a dozen dogs. And how the neighbor came back one day and said, "I left my dogs for 3 days. And when I came back, the senior, oldest dog in that chevra gave me that, like, you know, that, like, I'm angry with you." So Ramesh was talking about how a Kalev has personality. And he described from his teenage years and from his pre-teen years,
right.
When he was a kid. While he was in Tel Aviv, he was beloved by the Belzer Rebbe. So the Belzer Rebbe still had Tish. I think about Aaron Rebels. You said Tel Aviv had a lot of Hasidus in those days. The famous story that Rabbi Tatz always tells over was with Ger Hasidim in Tel Aviv. The story about David HaMelech dancing. Remember that story? David HaMelech was dancing and Michal said, "This is how the greatest king of Israel, this is how he behaves in front of the people. He dances with a Sefer Torah like a child, like a goat. And he said, he said, "Do you think that this is what I could do? I could dance much more." And Ramesh explains that's not what he meant. And he heard this as a child from these Ger Hasidim from Varsha, right? These old Ger Hasidim from Varsha. He said, no. He said, "Do you think this is what I can hide from myself? There are layers upon layers upon layers of hiddenness that I'm keeping away from the people. Don't worry, it's still there. So all these stories, Ramesh was like that too. Yeah.
He only showed you as much as he wanted to show you.
Akivas used that as a self-portrait of Ramesha. That what Ramesha said about David HaMelech, explained to Michal that the real me is totally hidden. That's why I named the Sefer Looking Into the Sun, because we always felt that we never really knew what he was all about, and we didn't. Every day, last night I had another scoop. Can I say my scoop? It's a little controversial. Sure. Last night,
controversy is what keeps the Rabbi Olasky show going. Yeah.
So, a lot of things have come out since the book has been published. Probably a good thing, because it probably should not be in the book. Yeah. But the last 2 weeks, I just came back from America, and Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson, who I spent half an hour with him. He came to speak at Yarchikala and see his wife. He sat down with me and said, "Let me tell you stories about your Rebbe."
How does he know?
So Y.Y. Jacobson is extremely broad. He's extremely broad. So he schmacked that you can get a lot from Rav Moshe. He told me that there's few people in the generation that knows Likutei Torah of Chabad like Rav Moshe does.
Which is very surprising because, you know, we had a story about that.
Yeah, okay. This is not everything is for the Rabbi Olasky show. Not everything, okay? Not everything needs to be told. And he said over that probably his last Shal Shittas Torah before he passed, it was at the very end of his sickness. He was staying in Muncie, and he was saying Shal Shittas Torah in a basement shul in Muncie. And there was like, if I remember correctly, it was 20 or 30 of us. And he started talking. It was very hard for him to speak. And then Shabbos was over, and he said to the Chevra, "Do you mind if I speak a little longer?" So Rabbi Y.Y. said, "Please, okay, we're all okay with it." He spoke for another hour, okay, for another hour. Now, Rabbi Jacobson is a genius. He was a chazer for the Lubavitch Rebbe. So he was able to remember everything. I immediately took out, when he told me the story, I took out my WhatsApp notes. I said, "Tell me all about what he said." So I have a recording of Ramesh's last speech where he was speaking all this Kabbalah stuff. I had no idea what he was talking about. I immediately sent it to Rabbi Rudman. I'm still waiting for Reb Zev to give me a summary of all the stuff that he said in his last Shal Shudas. But it opened up another vista. Rabbi Jacobson said about incredible things that he said about the Baal HaTanya, which we never heard. We never heard this side of him. About he said that, you know, if the Baal HaTanya would have been around, he said, "I would run to him in my pajamas, right, to be able to sit at his feet to learn some Torah." So that was something I heard.
Some complicated guy, Ramesh. Yeah,
it's about to get much worse.
Yeah, okay.
Are you sitting down?
Yeah, okay, I think so. Yeah.
I'm not so sure that I should be saying this. I'm probably going to regret this immediately after this, but, you know, I only live once.
That's why you're on this show, because here we have no filters. Yeah, okay.
Unfortunately, yeah, this is not. Okay, I'm going to regret this, but this is what last night I went to hear Shiv from Rav Moshe Weiss. And next to me is a Yid, Rabbi Zaks. He's a America's a Rav cook, you know, pays the whole thing. The real thing, a real Talmud Chacham. And he sees I'm carrying the Sefer. I bought it for someone. He says, "Oh, you know Rav Moshe?" He was a big Talmud Rav Hutner. He says, "Yeah," and we knew that. He says, "Do you know that he had a secret Chavura of Kisvi Rav Cook?" So I don't believe. He says, "Go and ask."
Well, that's not so surprising, because Rav Cook was a big guy. Everyone agrees he was a big guy.
Trust me, it's surprising. He said, "You don't believe me?" He says, "Ask Rav Shlanger," which I plan to do. Because Shlanger was one of the inner circles of, you know, the inner circles of Rav Moshe. But you're right. I mean, Rav Hutner himself used to have a picture of Cook in his sukkah, but later on he took it away. So I don't know, certain things.
Right, but Shlomo Zalman had a haskama in one of his svarim from Rav Cook. And when they wanted to reprint the sefer, they said, "We want to leave out the haskama." He says, "Then don't print the sefer."
So
like there were people who were Mechabed, Rav Cook. For political reasons, exactly, they had a problem, etc. Exactly, but the Mishnah never cared about that kind of stuff. He was so politically incorrect.
Yeah, but as he mentioned earlier, he knew his audience, and he would say what the audience needed to hear, right? He was a mechanech for his audience.
He was speaking at B'nai B'rak. Someone told me this story.
By the one thing, before I forget, he said about Rav Cook. He said Rav Cook was the Mor D'Shmeitz of Kedusha. He said if you wanted to learn the sugya of Kedusha, he was the person that you go to.
Really?
Yeah.
He was speaking of B'nai Brak, and it was during the Hit Not Kut.
Right.
And he did a whole thing about...
Hit Not Kut, you mean from Gaza?
From Gaza. And then, he did a whole thing about the people in Gaza and their Mesiras Nefesh and their Yiri Shemayim and B'nai Brak. And they were like, right. What? He goes, don't you tell me they have more Yiri Shemayim than you have that? And he just, you know...
Right.
Which
he was extremely broad.
The one thing Rav Moshe was terrified of was that he was going to get written up in the Yatayid. He said this once in the Chabur. He goes, what, I have to find my name in the Yatayid tomorrow? He worked so hard to keep himself, you know, under the radar, you know?
Right, right. But that was it.
That's why I only know one Kol Kore he ever signed.
Yeah.
That we're both familiar with.
Indeed.
Maybe we'll come back and talk about that one day. But anyway, but in general, he did everything he could to stay under the radar.
Yeah.
And he had, towards the end of his life, Gerber, what's that called? You know, when he couldn't move?
Yeah, I've forgotten. I know you're talking about.
Gerber syndrome or something? I forgot what.
It's in the book from the doctor that took care of him. Bar something syndrome, yeah.
So this was when there was the big fight between Eitz and Degel. You know, and the whole thing. And Rav Chaim Kanievsky called him up and said, I want you to write a letter, you know, in favor of Degel, you know, and against Eitz. And he says, Rebbe, I literally can't hold a pen. He couldn't move. And he said to somebody afterwards, it was such mazel. Was paralyzed. He says, because otherwise I couldn't say no to Rav Chaim Kanievsky, but I've stayed out of politics my whole life. It was the last thing I wanted to do was to get involved. But
right. That was yeah.
All right. So then he goes to Petach Tikva.
Right. Okay. So going back now.
I'm not very linear.
Okay. So he went to Lomja, and then afterwards he moved over at his bar mitzvah time. He moved over to Panovich, and then he stayed in Rav Dessler's house. So this is where this incredible.
So Dessler was. You said it was a
second cousin. Right. Uh-huh. But he was considered like a relative, a close relative, and Rav Dessler saw his potential, took it upon himself to build him. I have quite a few stories between him and Rav Dessler during that period. By the time he was 16, he had already learned Shara Kedusha with the Chavrusa with Rav Dessler. So, and he, again, the Rabbi Gershenfeld narrative, right, is that Rav Dessler was the one that built him and gave him this breadth of being able to learn from everyone. And
but this extreme Chajman, he had to be, he was 16 when Rav Dessler was Nifta.
Right.
So that was just a very short...
No. When his wife was... Okay, I don't remember.
That's what someone told me. I didn't make the Chajman. I'm not good.
Sure was when his wife is Nifta, the story with the with
I'm not
the
sure of anything. This is what someone told me. He says he learned his Kabbalah from Rav Dessler, but it had to have been in just a few years because they didn't know. What year did Rav Dessler was Nifta?
Rabbi Rosenblum, are you listening? I don't remember.
1950.
Something,
at least,
yeah.
You know? So figure out how Moshe was at that point, you know?
Okay, yeah. I never thought about that.
Right, that's actually what someone said to me once.
Yeah, I never wrote this book as a biographer. Keep that in mind. I wrote this book to write his Torah over
but
to the public.
It's just hard
and the
to follow.
Came out organically from
where
the Torah.
He came from. You know
so,
what I mean?
So then
like
I
he's,
just,
a, he's such like a, he's such yeah. a broad, complicated person. But he
spent,
came from
he
someplace.
Spent years in the mirror. He spent years in Chevron.
You know the story with Rabbi Gershenfeld with him and Rav Shach, Rav Moshe and Rav Shach.
Tell it over. It's a good one.
Rabbi Gershenfeld was teaching Rav Moshe's Torah in Hebrew University. So someone ratted on him because there's always people like this, you know. That's why when he was telling the story of the Ramchal, he was talking about, you know, how these people were persecuted, you know, when they, you know, there's always some kanoi out there who decides to go after them. So they ratted on Gershenfeld that he's teaching Kabbalah to you know, secular college students. So Rashach sent a message, I want to see you. So Gershenfeld runs to him and she goes, help! So Rashach says, I'll go for you. So he goes to Rashach. He says, I'm here to get a patch for my Talmud. I understand you want to give him a patch. Give the patch to me because he's only doing what I told him. So he says, this is not our mahalach. He says to Rashach, he says, what do you mean? You and I heard the mashkiach say these things over in Panovich. He says, me, Hadesla Hazeh? Fair.
No. That's not exactly
that's the way I heard the story. And
there's an exaggeration.
That's how I heard
the
story.
Tesla is Nitzmahalach.
Yeah.
That's what I heard.
But there's no question that when he came in, he expunged the Rav Dessler from Panovich, and that's when he brought in Rav Chatzkel, right. Old-time Musser, you know.
Right.
And that's why Rav Friedlander ran away. Because he was a Talmud of Rav Dessler. He says, oh, I'm next, you know. And then...
He was 18 when
Rav
Dessler was
left
here.
He was 18?
Okay, there we go. 18 is enough.
He was 18 when he was...
18 Rav Moshe Shapira years.
Yeah.
It's enough so, to get the Mahalach. Yeah.
So when Rav Chatzkel was nifter, so he asked for Friedlander to come back. He says, but none of the Dessler stuff. He says, I can't. I don't know anything else. I was my Rebbe. But yeah, his mahalach and Rav Dessler's mahalach. When I was in Chavetz Chaim, they said this is not our mahalach. We don't. This is not. And that's what Rav Moshe himself said to me. He says he made it up.
So I actually went with Rav Gershenfeld. We went to Rav Moshe, and we asked him, how could you teach what you do on Thursday nights to you don't know the public, and you're teaching literally the secrets of Torah. And he answered, this is a Kabbalah that I have, that it's a Hora Shah from Rav Dessler.
That's what he says. This is a Yimachazik, people on the moon. Is what
and then he sort of cryptically said, sometimes I wonder whether the Hora Shah still applies. I have no idea what that means. But that's what he said.
I guess it means if it's even worthwhile anymore.
Could be.
You know?
It could be.
Because he had a funny relationship with the Thursday night shiur. It was the only shiur he gave that was open to the public.
Right.
You know? So someone asked him once, how come you don't give Meir Makamos? He goes, what for? His people want to look it up. He goes, really? He says, I think they just come here so that when they go in Shiduchim, they could say, I go to Rav Moshe shiur. So a guy was there for like 3 years when he was leaving. He said, I want to thank you so much. I gained so much from the shiur. He goes, tell it to your wife. He had a consciousness that he didn't know who he was talking to and who was showing up, and he had a certain suspicion that it was not necessarily the people that he was looking for.
I also think there was Meir Makomos. I think it was more than that. He wanted people on the Thursday night show to learn him. Because he had a shita, he had a mahalach that he wanted to teach the world. He was very aware there was a machine that was recording him. He was for sure aware that one day he'd be 120 years old. And as we see now, there's a website called Lahavin that has hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Yeshurim from Thursday night, all on one website. And a scoop, which is the last thing I added to the sefer, literally it had already gone to press, and they put it in its little footnote, is that a new sefer came out 3 months ago called Dvar Shefa from Rabbi Ariel Sisro. Basically, he took the Thursday night shiurim, and when he saw that there was a certain pattern that he kept on going back to, he would combine them and wrote into a mimer, which is going to be the Rabbi Moshe Shapiro sefer on Chumash. I think it's going to be the one that is going to make it in big numbers. So Rabbi Moshe told his family that if they ever write up the Thursday night shiurim as a Chumash sefer, they should call it Dvar Shefa, because Shefa is the word Shapiro as a remez, but it's also Gematria Shulamis, which was his beloved daughter that passed away, and he wanted to give cover to his daughter, which is, by the way, how the Taharis shiur began.
All right, so you made reference to this earlier about and that he lost his daughter.
I thought we were going linear.
You're right. So he's in Panovich now.
Panovich, then he's Mir, learning, then Chevron.
Where was he in the Mir?
After he got married, he was learning in the Mir.
Who's the Rebbetzin?
Who's Rav Moshe's Rebbetzin?
What's her story?
What? Her father is Rav Bialystotsky. Her father was a Rosh Kol that had people like Diane Fisher and Shlomo Zalman went through that Kol. So her father, when he tested Rav Moshe, tested him on Kol HaTorah Kuloi in Shas and in Yerushalmi and things like that. And Rav Moshe said, by the way, you should know that he knows Sifri Maharal the same way he knows Shas and Poskim. But the point is that she came from a very, very, very old Yerushalmi family. And she herself is brilliant. Are we allowed to talk about this?
Well, this is my show. I can do my thing. Nobody, anyone who watches this knows they're in for the ride. Okay,
so the Rebbetzin was a lecture in Hebrew. I don't know why I'm saying this out loud.
In English literature.
And literature and philosophy.
And philosophy.
Yeah. I mean,
how did that happen to you, Shaul Miguel?
I don't want to talk about this publicly, but in Ramesh's bathroom, there was a little English section, you know, like adventures in 19th century American literature.
But Ramesh didn't read them, did he?
So
did he read English?
Chanuch Teller claims that he was pretty much an expert. And he knew the principles of American literary knowledge. He was quoting stuff that Chanuch Teller says there's no way he could have known. And I had a story in there.
I remember somebody asked him once, are you allowed to learn English literature? He goes, Chveis, if you hold it to Chochmah. That's what I heard.
He was driving down Falstaff in Baltimore.
Baltimore.
And he turned to his driver. He says, you know Falstaff, you know what it's all about. There's no idea. He says, ugh, I'm Morris. You don't know Shakespeare. He always came out with these surprising lines. You never know what he picked up in between. It's this crazy thing. Somebody saw him when he was in Moscow reading a Russian newspaper. We're trying to read Russian, figuring it out, looking at the Russian writing.
But did he speak English? He didn't speak English.
When he needed to speak English, he spoke English.
So what's the shot? How come he never spoke English?
It's not an evolution, it's a revolution.
He said that to me was Zvezda's. Zvezda's low motivation.
Right.
So I was driving with him once, me and Ami Cohen, right. Ami Cohen's son. And, you know, I was just a driver, you know, so he'd say, make a left, you know, go straight. So afterwards, I said to Ami, I says, he thinks I don't speak Hebrew. He goes, no, he was showing off. But he never spoke in English.
He never spoke in English in principle.
Because?
He didn't want to speak a foreign language. He would only speak in Hebrew and Yiddish. But in America, he would speak to people in English.
And, like a conversation?
And if you listen to the Monday show, where our friends from Arsameach went, people were asking questions in English all the time. And he would answer back in Hebrew. And I actually have been listening now to the Monday show, and Rabbi Pesach Siegel sends them to me when my travels. And he speaks a lot of English in that share. He felt sorry for those educators. Yeah, he just would explain things to them in English.
Okay, so he gets married.
Right.
To this. How does a Yerushalmi woman come to give Shiram in Hebrew University in philosophy and English literature? How does that happen to a Yerushalmi girl? Did she go to college?
I have no idea. I think and any theory I have, I think I'm just going to keep my mouth shut.
I heard the following story that somebody called him up, a Dayan.
Yeah, we know this Dayan.
Right. And said, I want to send my daughter to the Mechala, but I'm afraid it'll hurt for Shidduchim. He says, it will. He says, but you sent your daughter to Yale. Now, who's that?
Columbia.
It was Columbia?
Yeah.
Who is that? How come his daughter went to Columbia?
Well, wait, finish the story.
Okay. So he says, but you sent your daughter to Columbia. And he says, when your name is Moshe Shapiro, you can do that too.
Yeah, exactly.
But how did his wife get into a lecture in Hebrew University in English literature? And how did his daughter go to Columbia? What's going on here?
We have to be very careful over here. This is a different age and different types of people. You see BJJ, Rebbetzin David. So she had students that went on to Ivy League colleges and would marry Rosh Yeshivas. So it was a little bit of a different type of a personality that could juggle both ends, and they could go into a university campus.
Because you would never know it when you meet the Rebbetzin.
Yeah.
That she's lecturing in Hebrew University. She was such the Yerushalmi Rebbetzin,
right,
that you would never sense it.
Right. And she was also a loving mother and bubby to us. To us, when we were Bochrim, so her home was...
I'm one of six boys, so there were no girls. So we were expected to join in with all the housework and stuff like that. So I did not know how to sit through a Suda. My mother would say, okay, it's the maid's day off. And we'd get up, we would clear, we would serve, etc. So I was a very popular Shabbos guest when I was a Bochrim because I didn't know how to sit through a meal. I would right away start clearing that, you know. Anyway, so when I was there for Purim, I would start clearing off the table and bring things in. The Rebbetzin says to me, you know, no, I do that. And I said, I'm sorry, I had a poor chinuch. My mother didn't bring me up that way. I don't know how to sit in a suit and not help, you know what I mean? But she was...
That was it. I just tell you, the last time she spoke to me, the last season before Ramesha died, since then we've spoken about, the last season before Ramesha died, I came to the house with an invitation, I think it was for my daughter Shira, to invite her to the wedding. And she saw what was happening. And she called me up and said, listen, do me a favor. He says, my husband, he gave his whole life to you and your friends. He was always there for you. Now you have to give back to him. Do me a favor and don't try and make him come to this wedding. He's not well enough. But she was completely and totally fully aware of what he was doing. Not 1,000%. For example, during the Gulf War, I knocked on his door to ask Mishael if I could fly to South Africa for my niece's wedding. And he said, I don't know what's going on, but since the Gulf War has began, Ramesh has been like very mysterious. He has some kind of a chabura where they're doing special tefillos and tikkunim and all kinds of like da-na-na-na-na Kabbalah stuff. And so I don't know where he is half the time since the war began. And I realized, oh my gosh. Okay, so his wife does not know where he's hiding off with his Kabbalah friends. But in general, they were a team. I actually have a memory of seeing them walking on her Herzl. The two of them were going for a walk together. Just seeing the two of them. It was just such a beautiful thing to see. And Adam Gadol and his Isha Gadola wife just going for a stroll. That mountain there, which we go the shortcut between Harnof and Vaiva Gan.
When you look at how he approaches things and his concern, it's just amazing that he has time to talk to people, you know? Like you talk about the invitation. I was very conscious. I would not hock Reb Moshe. You know, there were people who would hock him. I wouldn't hock him. If I needed him, right, you know, I was desperate. If you're old enough to remember from the 1970s, I think it was, or the 19, it was a TV show called The A-Team, you know. If you need them and you can find them, they're the A-Team. That's how I felt for my show. You're like, you know, if I really need to talk to him, you know. So I showed up the Friday Shir once and I gave him an invitation to my daughter's wedding. So he says, David, I'll tell you a day. I said, no, I don't expect you to come. I have no expectations. I said, it's a covered for me to give you an invitation to my daughter's wedding. But I don't expect
He did come to when your son Yaakov did.
So he says, Ein shum hakpada? I said, lo. Because azani mechuyav lavo. That's what he said. That's what he said. And he showed up, mamish, late at night when it was like the end. We were cleaning up, you know. He was like, I told you I would come. And I was like, oh, I didn't want to make you come. I Davka did it not for him to come. I just wanted to give him an invitation, you know.
It's incredible.
Busha not to do it beforehand,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, he I don't know how he did it.
He showed up everywhere. He was everywhere at the same time.
I remember once he was on the way to the airport and he told the driver, stop up, Nissel's making a bar mitzvah. Right? He came in, he didn't even come in. He just came in. I think it was David Meir. David Meir was giving his mitzvah drasha. He stood at the back. He said afterwards, he said, you should know, I came in, I heard your son's drasha, but I had to run to catch the plane. He says, your son, he spoke like a senator. Yeah. So, he was, wait a second. That wedding that he didn't come, he called me up. I suddenly see the phone. I see it's him. And it's crazy.
How did he know? His wife wouldn't give him the invitation.
I don't know how it happened. He knew about the wedding. And I ran out of the wedding hall. And he gave me just effusive brachos. He was there for me. Oh, I have another scoop.
Yeah.
Another scoop. Ron Ilan. Ron Ilan is the pilot that comes with us in Rabbi Reuben Shul. So Ron Ilan made a wedding the same day that Yaakov Yisrael got married. So Ron Ilan told me, he says, you know, that Ramesha apologized to me that he was going to go to my son's wedding and not his son's wedding. He says, because Yaakov Yisrael, who today, Baruch Hashem, has this amazing yeshiva, he says, Yaakov Yisrael has an independent relationship with me and I'm going for Yaakov. That's what he told me. So Ron Ilan told me, he said, no, I got the better end of the deal. Because Ramesha felt so bad afterwards, he popped up at one of the Sheva Brachas. And then we asked him to speak, and he spoke. And he stayed there quite a while. So who got the better deal?
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, Ramesha was like, I don't know. He was, I don't know how he did this, where's Where's Willy Wonka? I don't know how he did it. Where's Waldo? I don't know how he managed to pop up everywhere all the time at the right places, but he has some kind of a magic. He had some abilities to do these things.
Okay, so then he goes to the mirror.
Right.
And he just learns in the mirror.
I just want you to know that he did not just learn in the mirror. Okay, the opening story in chapter one, which is the section of Torah, which is the hardest thing for me to write, because I wanted people to know that Ramesh is not just the Kirov and the person that did this whole revolution and outreach.
His ability to tie Torah to everything,
right,
to me was... you mentioned earlier our friend Zev Rudman, right?
Yeah.
Who's one of the few people I ever saw Ramesha speak to with respect. Take seriously. Because yeah. I was not one of them.
That's a good reason.
In fact,
yeah.
You know, I was thinking about how he used to yell at people. You know, he was always so nice to me. Super nice. And people noticed it. So he says, how come he never yells at you? He says, because he knows I'm a baby. I said, I won't cry. I'll just die. I'll just have go, and fall to the floor and die. He yelled
I'll
at
never
me.
Forget when you came in that Purim to his house.
Yeah.
Do you remember what he said about you? Yeah. The funniest rabbi in the world.
So
that's how I introduced you. And I said to him, but you're always depressed in Purim.
You know,
I said, you used to get depressed in Purim, Reb David. I remember that.
He went to
wait. You know, Ramesh said.
I still do.
Well, yeah. Ramesh said, you know, says, you know why he gets to? He's the only one that really understands what Purim is all about.
Sure. It's just the Holocaust. Just didn't happen. But it's almost the Holocaust. But he saw the sign up in the JLE. So, like, I think I had spoken to Zev beforehand about me coming to the Tuesday show, whatever right. it is. And he says, you know, David Orlovsky, he's a machanic. He goes, Ken Kane is the funniest rabbi in the world.
So
I said, was he making fun of me? He goes, no, he was jealous. Because he's the funniest rabbi in the world.
Wait a second. Let me.
Well, let's get back to the mirror.
Before we get to the mirror, let's get back to you.
Yes.
Because you did write in my book the section about his humor.
I didn't write anything in your book.
You did.
I've never seen your book.
There's a chapter. You can't. It's in print. You can't hide, Rabbi.
I'm looking. You gave me a copy because I have one copy of the book that I supposedly wrote that I never wrote. I only have one copy someone gave me. That's all I got.
There's a chapter called Laughter. Okay.
Yeah.
One of the things I did in my book was I hid behind people because I wanted to try and get as many people to speak in their own voice. That way I could, if I said something controversial, so it wasn't me.
No, but also it's very hard because there's 100 different Reb Meishas.
Right.
Talk to 100 people, you'll see 100 different Reb Meishas.
Correct.
Like I told you, Chanuch Teles saw one, you know, Michal Kaplan saw one. There's just different.
So I have Reb Meisha described by Yeshua Eichenstein, and I have Reb Meisha described by Chanuch Teles. I have different people from different things, and then I have the French Rabbanim speaking about him, and the Russian. The point I want to make is...
Were you the one who told me that in the Friday Shir...
I feel sorry for our listeners. We both have ADD. This is
listen,
not normal.
They know what they're in for.
Yeah.
Otherwise, they could go and listen to somebody else on tour anytime. This is the only thing in the world like this. There's nothing like this. In fact, somebody said something that was deeply meaningful to me because I felt it too. They said, I saw a lot of different interviews with Nissen Black. He goes, but I never saw him like he was with you. It was a different kind of thing. So that's how I feel, that we do something special here. I really do.
You're getting me to say things I regret.
That's what we try to do.
Exactly. We've
destroyed many a career in this the Rabbi Orlovsky show. But I thought it was you who told me in the Friday Shir that before they would start, Josh Hartman would just sit there and tell Ramesha jokes. Just whatever jokes he had, you know?
Yeah.
So,
but that was incredible. So most of listen, there was only once that I heard Ramesha tell a joke. He told just because it was funny.
It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Torah and Simcha, ready to go. The Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Knowledge and wisdom will help you grow. Lots of fun in every episode. And we don't have to rhyme. No, we don't. It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show on RabbiOrlovsky.com. Torah, anytime, YouTube, and more. It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Torah and Simcha, ready to go. It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. Till next time, till we meet again, it's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show. It's the Rabbi Orlovsky Show.